Oh, some of you have. Many of you may have seen the photos if you haven't actually been there yourself. And you notice that all the places you go to are always outside of town. Not that too far away that people can go and feed the monks and the nuns, but outside of town where it's nice and quiet and peaceful, amid the trees and the forests. And that was always the tradition in Buddhism, to have your monasteries, your temples, the places where the monks would live and people would go, in quiet, serene, peaceful places. So when people come and visit there, they can also enjoy some of the peace and quiet. And because outside of the cities were mostly forests, that's why they used to call it the forest tradition. But really, the word in Pali is Aranya, which means like the wilderness, outside of towns, outside the cultivated areas. And the definition, according to our monks Vinaya, as long as you're at least 1 kilometer or more from the nearest house or village, then it qualifies to be a forest monastery. And of course, that's why I spend all my life as a monk, except when I'm in Singapore. And now I'm in the concrete forest. This is in the forest monasteries of Thailand and now in Australia. And I must admit, when I first became a monk, I didn't really know much about what Buddhism was. I had some idea. But then you went to see these amazing teachers. And these were teachers who lived among the trees in the forest with the animals. And they get the marvelous stories of what happens when you live close to nature. And it was so inspiring. Now, many of you know my bio. You know, I was scholarships all the way, even though I came from a poor home. From my primary school, a scholarship to one of the best schools in West London. From there, a scholarship to Cambridge, a scholarship all the way. I had this great education. And then I went to see Ajahn Chah, who'd only finished grade 4. And when I talked to him, after 5 minutes, it was quite clear who was the most intelligent. I was stupid compared to this great monk. And I realized, how can someone like that become so wise? And he said a lot of his wisdom actually came from living in the forest and observing nature and observing just what happens in the world. Now, one of those observations is one of the stories in my book. And it's a very beautiful story. What happens when you live in a forest monastery? And this was not Ajahn Chah, but one of the other monks of his generation, who was staying in a forest in a jungle alone. And they don't stay in big penthouses or great elaborate huts. Most of those huts were just made out of bamboo and thatch. So every year the villagers would come and sort of fix up any holes. And it was very, very simple. And also, it was environmentally friendly. Everything got recycled every year. So, he was staying in that simple hut one night when there was a storm. A very violent storm came through the area. And the winds were strong and the rain was lashing down, as you do get storms in every part of the world. But these were one of those very heavy storms where, first of all, the branches came down and then whole trees were uprooted. And of course, he was in this very fragile hut. If any big branch or tree fell on top of his hut, there was no protection. The very best, he would probably break bones and be very badly injured. Probably, though, he would be crushed to death. So all night, he was meditating, staying awake, as these great trees, bang, crash, around him. For any of you who do public talks, always have a few bangs and crashes to keep people awake. And anyhow, a few bangs and crashes throughout the night. But not one of them actually hit his hut. They sounded very close. And in the early morning, when the storm had settled down, when it was calm again, he went outside to see the damage. He was very lucky. A few big branches and trees had only just missed his hut. Another foot this way, a foot that way, and he would have been killed. He was so lucky, but he noticed something very strange. By observing nature, he started to understand something very powerful about life. He noticed the leaves on the forest floor. Most of the leaves were old brown leaves, which had lived a full life on the branches and twigs. But amongst those old brown leaves lying dead on the forest floor were several yellow leaves, a few green leaves, and he even noticed one or two fresh green leaves, which could only have sprouted from the twigs the day before. They too lay alongside the old brown leaves, torn from the tree of life by the heavy storm. He smiled and looked up, and as you'd expect, most of the leaves remaining on the branches and twigs were the young green leaves, strong, able to withstand the force of the wind. But even though many brown leaves were on the forest floor, he even noticed amongst those green leaves still clinging on to life were a few curly old brown leaves, which despite the storm were still clinging on to life. And he realized that's exactly the same with human beings and life and death. When winds of life and death and sickness and disease come through our communities, they usually take the old brown leaves. The uncles and aunties who've lived such a long time in Singapore. And I notice a few old brown leaves here today. But even though young green leaves, kids and children die, still these old brown leaves cling on every year. Every year I come here, they're still alive. He understood about the nature of life and death. It doesn't just pick the old people, it picks the young people as well. And nothing is wrong. This is just nature. It's a law of nature, what we call in Buddhism, Dhamma, nature, truth. And this is an example of the sorts of things you learn by living amongst nature, where the laws of nature have not been bent and forced by human intervention. You do actually start to see the nature of things, the way they truly are. So we learn a lot by living in the forest, by living in nature. Sometimes it can be very harsh, like all the mosquitoes which live in the jungles. And imagine what it was like for me. I wasn't used to mosquitoes. I came from London. I went to a good university. It was too cold for mosquitoes in that place. So I had no experience of them when I went to stay in these jungle monasteries. And there's one thing about mosquitoes in Thailand. Number one, over all of those years, they've been genetically programmed. When they see a monk, they know it's a free, safe meal. Because we're not allowed to go. So they know, they see a brown robe, whoopee, we're safe. Number two, you can see the way we wear our robes over one shoulder, we've got bald head. We've got so much more exposed skin than you. There are more seats at the dinner table. And lastly, when I went to Thailand, these were remote areas. There's many places I went to, and I was the first Westerner the villagers had seen. And the first Westerner the mosquitoes had tasted. You know what it's like when you first get Western food coming in? Everyone goes for the first couple of weeks to try it out. That's what happened in Thailand. All the mosquitoes told each other, hey guys, there's a Westerner over here. I mean, you've already had Thai food you can have every day of the week. You can have Western food today. So they all come on top of you. Now here you are with no mosquito repellents, no mosquito coils, no mosquito nets in the jungle, meditating with all these mosquitoes around you. Now this is actually how you learn Dhamma. Sometimes it's very irritating. And so sometimes what we would do, we couldn't squash them, we could actually flick them off. You know, every time I flicked them off, they did, like, in aeronautics, a loop-de-loop, and they landed somewhere else. So instead of one irritation, you had two bumps. It was crazy to try and do anything about it, made it much worse. So you just let it go, let it be. And one thing I noticed, because sometimes we would meditate in the jungle, outside, in the evening, and all these mosquitoes would come up, and literally, the first few months there, it was very, very hard to endure. I'd play a game with a fellow monk. He was an American monk. His name was Jotika. I always remember him. To see who could count the most mosquitoes on their arm at one time. Usually get up to about 60 or 70. And you couldn't actually count anymore. They were too close together. You couldn't so distinguish them. And I'm sure I could hear them slurping as all the blood was draining from them. No, that's not true. Now, that was very hard to endure. And very often I'd open my eyes and want to run away. But I'd see all the other monks sitting absolutely still. And I was too proud to run away. So instead of doing that, I did something else. I just let go. I never fought. I just made peace with this. You know what happened? When you made peace, you got so calm and still that you couldn't feel the body anymore. You just got so deep inside in meditation. And when I came out afterwards, usually after mosquito bites you as a Westerner, you have many little bumps on the skin because you have a little reaction. Because, you know, we're not used to it. We're not genetically programmed for mosquitoes. But when after I came out of meditation, there was no bumps at all. It was as if no mosquitoes had bitten me. Years and years later, I found out another truth, that mosquitoes, they're attracted to the carbon dioxide coming out of your pores. That's actually what they recognize, and that's what they see. There's a human being there, someone to eat. But when you really calm down, your whole metabolism gets so slow and peaceful that hardly any carbon dioxide comes out from your pores. You actually become invisible to the mosquitoes. The more you worry and strive, the more you say, mosquitoes, here I am, come and get me. But the more calm and peaceful you are, the more you disappear. And I found that so often with living in the forest, in the jungle. When you worried a lot, when you were sort of not still and peaceful, all sorts of rotten things would happen to you. When you relaxed and were peaceful, the whole forest would actually be on your side. Another story, for example, living in the forest monasteries, living very simply. It wasn't just simply, but we were quite ascetic and austere. Oh, you want people to move on? Move closer, okay. So, you want to come closer to the source of power, please come closer. Because more people want to try and get in. So come a bit closer, squash up. Very good. To give more opportunity for people over in the back. Especially, there's lots of ghosts trying to get in, so if you can move it. So, living in these jungle monasteries, there's not just mosquitoes. There's tigers, bears, elephants, and snakes. Dangerous snakes. When I first went there, I asked about the snakes, and they said, in Thailand, there are 100 different species of snake. 99 are very venomous. If they bite you, you're in big trouble. That's 99 of the 100. And the other 100th one strangles you to death. They're all very dangerous. But you were living with the snakes. You saw them every day, many times. They crawled up on you sometimes. Sometimes, you know, in the hot weather, you know, you'd lay down at night just with your lower robe on. And every now and again, tarantulas would drop from the roof. And just run over your chest. They're very tickly. They're quite nice, though. And they're real tarantulas and snakes crawling all over you. Now, on this one occasion, every week on the moon nights, the full moon, the new moon, and the half moon, it was our tradition from Ajahn Chah, we'd stay up all night meditating. We were not sort of into sleeping and resting and indulging in anything. So we'd stay up meditating all night. And this one evening, early in the morning, once the sun had rose, we were just going to get ready to go off on our arms round. But of course, meditating for such a long time, you had to go to the toilet. But in the forest, you don't have to use the bowl toilet. It's a whole forest, you know, you can urinate in. And it's like recycling. It's environmentally friendly. You know, we were far more green, you know, years ago than anyone is now. So, you know, when you're up into the forest, and you know, in Asia, you squat down to urinate. I squat down to urinate in the jungle, in the forest. Now, remember two things. I've been meditating all night, so I was a bit sleepy. Number two, it's just the first light of day, so you couldn't see things all that clearly. I really thought I was urinating on a stick. But then the stick started to move. And for those males here, that mouth of that very venomous snake was only an inch or two away from the most sensitive part of my body. That's very dangerous. But because you're peaceful, you're a forest monk, you've got good karma and lots of merits, that snake never bit me. He just happily just moved away. I often thought of that afterwards. When you're peeing on a snake, why wouldn't it bite you? And I realized afterwards, because it was holding water. A nice warm bath early in the morning from the holy monk. Oh, the snake probably thought, oh, I'm so lucky, I have a lucky day today. So one of the things living in nature, you have a lot of fun, a lot of joy, a lot of peace, and you learn so much from the animals. Even snakes, they would never ever hurt or bite you, even though they crawled over you. The tarantulas, who were dropped from the river, they just ran over you. They wouldn't want to bite. They couldn't eat you. Why would they bite you? The only reason why animals attack you is because they're afraid. They're afraid that you might hurt them. But when you're sort of, you know, a nice, peaceful, kind monk who doesn't want anything, who just wants to have other people being peaceful and happy, even the animals realize that. So when you live in a forest, you have to have metta. You have to be kind. If you're not kind, you've not got metta, then the animals sense that and they might go for you. So just living in a forest meant you had to train very well, being a peaceful, kind, gentle, and also making sure that you were a worthy monk. Otherwise you couldn't stay in that forest. Even the Buddha said, these forests in which he lived in his time, he said, they're very scary, and if you haven't got your act together, monks, you'll get very afraid. But those monks who are peaceful, kind, and wise, you have nothing to worry about at all. You have a beautiful time in there. And even, our mate, this is Singapore, you all like ghost stories. In many of these forest monasteries, also in the jungles, that's where they would actually take the corpses to be burnt. And that's where all the ghosts would hang out. You all ask yourself, why is it you only see the ghosts, you know, in your rooms or your temples or hospitals during the night time? Where do they go during the daytime? They go to the forest monasteries. That's where they hang out. But when you're very peaceful and calm, these other beings, they never harm you. Just like any other being in the universe, if you're kind and gentle, it loves you. Why are you coming here? It's not because of the talk, because I'm kind and I'm gentle. How many times have I shouted at anyone here in all the years I've been coming? Never once. Even though some of you deserve a shouting. No, you don't. Because you're kind and gentle. When you're kind and gentle, you know, the animals love you, the people love you, the devas love you, everybody likes you. And that's why, as a monk living in these so-called dangerous places, as long as you're kind and gentle, then you will survive very well. So it's like almost like a test, an examination. Only the very, very good monks and nuns can actually stay in places like that, the good lay people. Otherwise, they just get too afraid and run away. So that's a test. This is why the forest monasteries usually bring out the best in the monks and the nuns. And it's just too far away, you know, in those days. Well, look, in those days, the first year or two, well, even now, there was no electricity. I think there is electricity there now. In my day, no electricity in that monastery. No road. So it was just a piece of jungle. With no electricity, it meant if you got sick, you just meditated, became peaceful. There's no doctor, no dentist. You really learn how to endure. And I think you all know these days, a lot of the time sicknesses, if you have a good mind, peaceful and kind, the sickness usually abates. Your body has got many, many ways of healing itself, if you only can rest and give it a chance. So as monks we learn how to meditate and not get so upset with little aches and pains. Now, I don't know, even here today, the last few days, because it's very hot in Singapore today. Do you want the air con on? Now, you can put it on if you want. You can turn it off if you want. Because, you know, I've lived in the forest, in the jungles. There's no air con in the jungle. There's no fans. If it's hot, you know what I say when it's hot? What should you do? Keep a cool head. When it's cold, keep a warm heart. In other words, you don't think too much about it. You have to. That's our training. Living in such austerity meant you were tougher, not because of inner willpower, but because of inner wisdom power. You learn how to say, oh, don't worry about these things. It's hot now. It'll cool off later on. It's cold. It'll soon warm up. It's no big deal. Stop worrying about it and thinking about it so much. And because we lived in a forest like this, we were very simple. No electricity, which meant you didn't have phones and TVs and radios. Oh, it's so wonderful to have none of these things. Every now and again, someone would bring a newspaper in the article. There's an article in the Sunday Times this morning about he who has nothing. That's me. And sometimes you see a newspaper. And what I told this to the journalists yesterday, I don't know if it was in the article, I haven't read it fully yet, I just saw the title, but every now and again, you'd see a newspaper come to our monastery, maybe every couple of months. And one thing I noticed was the stories were always the same, just the names and the countries had changed. Maybe war, you know, a few years ago it was, I don't know, United States and Vietnam. And now, United States and Afghanistan. Next time, it'll be United States and Iran, I don't know. But the stories were always the same, just the characters had changed. You know, elections, corruption, scandals, all the same stories. It's just the names have changed, that's all. So if you look at it, so what do you want to read a newspaper for anyway? You know what's in there, just the same story, different names. Same plot, different characters. So it was great. And one of the things I noticed, because you never had a TV, no radio, obviously no internet, no newspapers in those days, you know, I literally forgot not what day it was, what year it was. I remember somebody coming to see me in the monastery, and I had to fill out some form. And it was, you know, they had the year. And say, what year is it now? And I'm not exaggerating. Because you went to this beautiful, timeless, natural world. Now you ask the birds what year it is. They don't know. You know, what day it is. Is it a Sunday or a Monday? You're going to work today, you're not going to work. The birds and the animals, they don't care about that stuff. And like a monk, that's what I was like. Didn't know what year it was. Didn't know what month and day it was. You go in this beautiful, timeless realm where you had no worry about the future or the past. And this is the sort of peace you get in a forest monastery. If you're in a city somewhere, you always know whether it's a weekend because people will come to see you and bother you. If during the weekday, they're happily working. You know, if it's a holiday time, oh, you really have to work hard. That's why people, you know, come to our monastery in Perth, which is also outside of the city, a forest monastery. Any long weekend or holiday time, they all come and say, oh, isn't it wonderful to have a weekend off? Weekend off, I say. I've got to work harder now. It's a holiday. But it's anyway. So you get a beautiful timeless realm in like the forest monasteries. You really get away from the world, which is why the Buddha encouraged monks to do that. What is a monk anyway? Is that someone who's left the world? How can you live the world when you're living in a penthouse in the city? Is that really leaving the world? So forest monks, we live very simply. And we don't just say this. How many of you have gone to visit my monastery in Perth? Bodhinyana Monastery. Many of you have seen that. Richard and Linda were there a couple of days ago. And you've seen my cave. I actually come and show people, look, I don't just say this. This is where I live, how I live. You can look under the mats to see if there's any magazines. Open the drawers, you know, where's his TV. You can investigate. We actually do live simply. That's why I love taking people there and say, look, this is not just spin. Come and have a look for yourself. You can go in my room. You can search everywhere. I've got nothing to hide. And it's wonderful doing things like that because then people see exactly that this is a forest monk. You don't have many, many things. And why do you need so many things anyway? I mean, come on. Even in that article, I mean, one thing I said I saw was in the article this morning. He said, no, you need money when you go travelling. He said, what do I want money for when I go travelling? You know, in Changi Airport, there's all these shops there, but not one shop has got rose, my colour. So I can't go shopping. What does the monk want anyway with money? So you don't need to go shopping. And if there's no one there, if you are thirsty, there's always in Changi, you can get some water for free. There's enough there. When you get on the aircraft, you know, people feed you. So what do you want money for anyway? You're looked after all the way. So I tell them to people, look, as a monk, what do you want money for? Now, I'll tell you why we don't want money as monks. Because even though this is how the Buddha actually taught, you can actually look it up in the books for yourself. This is one of the core rules for monks. There's two core rules for monks. No sex, no money, basically. And it's obvious why. Same with nuns. If monks have sex, they're not monks. They're just fakes. And if they have lots of money, that's not what a monk is about. We're supposed to have left the world. Have vows of poverty and simplicity, no sex, celibacy, because we have happiness somewhere else. That's what a monk is about. Everybody knows that, even if you're not Buddhist. But one thing we are allowed, according to the rules laid down by the Buddha, that if I help any of you, and you say, Ajahn Brahm, look, I've already given a donation to your retreat center, your monastery or whatever, but I want to give something for you. Now, something personal. And what you're allowed to do, but I'm going to say, please never do this, because I'm going to explain why. You can say, look, you have to say the amount. You say, $50, Singh. Anything you'd like for that, let me know. Anything personal. The first time that happened, I was a young monk, maybe 3 or 4 years as a monk in Thailand. And I really helped someone, counseled them and got them through some difficulties. And they told me this. They said, look, we've already given donations to the monastery. We want something for you. We want to show our appreciation personally for you. You can understand how they feel. They say, we've got 100 baht. Now, those days, 35 years ago, that was a considerable amount of money. 100 baht, what do you want? And my mind went blank. I didn't really want anything, but here the guy was offering me the worth of 100 baht, and I was scratching my head. And like many people, he said, look, hurry up, I've got to go somewhere. And I had an idea. I said, look, I will go back to my hut tonight, and I will think about it, and I'll make a list. You can come back tomorrow. He said, good idea, because I'm busy. So off he went, and I went back to my room. I got a piece of paper out, and I said, now what do I want? And actually, I noticed my pen was actually not working very well, so I actually needed a pen. So I wrote down a pen. And actually, the piece of paper was just an old second-hand used piece, so I need a little notebook as well. You know, when in these huts it's so dark under candlelight, so I actually needed a bigger candle and some more matches to light the candle. And while we're talking about lights, my old flashlight was really sort of terrible. So I wrote down a flashlight as well and some batteries. And I soon noticed 100 baht wasn't enough. And as I thought, what should I take off? More things came into my mind which I needed. I actually needed some aerograms, actually, because I needed to write to my mother in England, and also some other stamps because I needed to send her things. I started writing this list down. It got bigger and bigger. In 5 minutes, 1,000 baht was not enough. And you know, I could not take anything off that list. Now I put it down. It was actually essential. I never knew how I could exist without it before. And that's where I saw what the problem was. So I stopped. And I caught that piece of paper, I scrunched it up, with anger, I must admit, and I threw it into the bin. And when I saw that guy the following day, I said, don't you ever do that to me again. I was such a happy monk, you know, when I didn't have any money to buy things. But as soon as I had money, all this craving came up. Now I had money, I could do things. And the thing I noticed was, 100 baht is never enough. $1,000. It's never enough. $1,000,000 is not enough. A billion is not enough. How many billionaires are there in Singapore who are still working their butts off, trying to make more? How much is enough? So because of that, it's a mark. It's not that we just don't have money because of the rules. We understand why we live simply. We live simply because of contentment. How much do you need? And I don't know, those of you who've met me at the airport, those of you who sent me to the airport, when you send me to the airport on tomorrow, you know my luggage? Who's got my luggage today? Look behind me. It's over there. Can you hold up my luggage? That's my luggage. That's what I travel with. So I don't have to have any check-in luggage. It's all cabin. And when I get to the other end, when I get to places like Perth, the United States, you go through the customs, and they always say, "Sir, where are your suitcases?" That's all I've got. I said, "How?" I said, "Look, I'm a monk." And you know, wherever I go, these are not Buddhists, you know, Christians, Hindus, I don't know who they are. As soon as they see this, they say, "Well done." They actually really appreciate and respect the fact that you are a real monk who has few possessions. And you're acting like that. And I tell them that what the Buddha said is in the suttas. He said, "Monks, nuns, you should be like birds. Wherever they fly, they only take the weight of their two wings." Have you ever seen a bird carrying a suitcase? When they migrate from country to country, do they take a backpack for just in case things? So be like a bird, you feel so free. And what you're saying here is you can be so free and happy with few things. And what a wonderful, inspiring teaching that is in our modern age, in economic crises times, you can see you don't need that much to be happy. If you have it, fine. If you don't have it, you don't have anything to worry about. In fact, the more you lose in this current financial crisis, you may not agree with me, but later on you say, "Yes, I understand." You will actually be more happy. You will. Because you've got free, you've got less things to worry about. And as I said, on the first night, if you have to downsize and get a smaller apartment in a HDB flats or something, now you're all together in a small apartment with your loved ones. You're together. As I say, in some houses, when you can't find your daughter or your son, you have to set a search party through the mansion, trying to find out what room they're in in modern times. But so it's simple, you know, forest monastery simplicity is because of happiness and peace. So we do this for inspiring other people and also for being simple yourself. All these years I never needed anyone. That's a forest tradition. And what happens is because the forest tradition, living outside of the city with no electricity, no TVs, very few newspapers, you know, you learn what's happening every now and again. So what can you do all day? You've got no TV to watch, no book to read. You've got no other choice but to meditate. So it almost forces you to be mindful, to be still, to be content. When you're not watching the TV, you're watching the world, you're watching nature, or you're watching yourself. When you're not having to be caught up with all the stuff on the internet, actually you're being able to feel the wind on your face. You can actually see the sunrise. You're not busy that you're taken away from all these wonderful events of nature. You see the cycles of the moon and of the seasons and of life. Things going round and round. Right now in our forests over in Australia, we see every year the two-headed animal. The animal with two heads. You only see this in Australia. The kangaroo. It's got one head in the middle and one head up here. Little babies. And that's what it looks like, because at this time of the year, you see the kangaroos, the little babies in the patch, always pokes his head out, and they're looking what's going on. And every now and again you see them jump out for the first time, just like any other kid, playful. And some of the little male goeys, they practice their boxing on their mother, and their mother swipes them, just like any other mother would. So it's just so much fun to see nature. That's much better than any television. Sometimes people have to watch Nature Channel to see this. I've got it live outside my front door. So we have a lot of fun there. We learn so much. When you're living simply, with not so many of these distractions, you learn so much about nature, human nature, your own nature, about how to be kind, about the beauty of simplicity, and the fact you don't need much to be happy. So all your fears and worries evaporate. If I can live on so little, what have I got to worry about? When I know that if I get sick, it's easy to deal with pain. And you learn that when you're very young. There weren't no doctors or dentists, so you had to find another way of dealing with the sicknesses and pains of life. You didn't have air cons. I remember reading in the Straits Times on the aircraft going back once that the government was very concerned about the young men going for national service, because in the tents, camping in the forest, there was no air con in the military tents. They got so soft. They're in the houses, in the schools, having aircon all the time. They never actually experienced life without aircon, except for a few minutes while they're walking between their air-conditioned car and their air-conditioned house. So sometimes that we get too soft. And as a monk, we are getting tough. And of course, sometimes you always get the question in Singapore, are monks vegetarian? And you know the answer, and Andy mentioned the other night, we couldn't be vegetarians. We had to eat whatever was given. And if I was fussy before I became a monk, when you became a monk, you lost all of that. And the type of disgusting food I ate, anybody here would get sometimes feel queasy when you heard what I ate. You already mentioned a frog the other day. That story was a ball of sticky rice about this big with a frog on top, boiled. And that was my one meal a day. That was it for the day. No tea, no coffee in those days, no chocolate, no sweets. Water, that's all you had. And this is no salt, no pepper, no sauces. Just a bare ball of sticky rice and a frog on top. It was enough for one each. And that was it for the day. Now that's disgusting. It tasted disgusting. But for those of you who don't know this story, the monk sitting next to me, I try and tell this story to children in schools to say, pay attention to your teachers. I paid attention to my biology teacher. The monk sitting next to me never did. So eating a frog, you need something for sustenance. So, the legs have some meat on it. It's like chicken, sort of, with a bit of imagination. Actually, with lots of imagination. It was tough, stringy, and tasteless. But at least, it was something you could eat. But then afterwards, what do I do next? You started eating the organs inside, because that's all you had. But at least I knew my biology. Monk next to me pressed this frog's bladder. And that bladder still had urine in it. And so this frog, imagine it sitting on this ball of rice, the only meal he's going to have that day, peed all over his rice. This yellow liquid came out. And no matter how hungry he was, he couldn't eat after that. Well, that's gross. Now from that, how on earth could you be fussy about food today? If I see some food and I don't like it, I think of that frog and say, this is delicious. So that toughness of being a forest monk, you weren't allowed to choose. Whatever people gave you, you had to eat. So the forest tradition, it was simple, it was austere, but not torturing you, but actually teaching you. You always had enough to eat, most times, but it wasn't the best food, it was just what was there. You lived in simple huts, nothing fancy, but enough to sleep the night. And you had no distractions, so you can meditate and become ever more peaceful. So the great meditation teachers came from this forest tradition. There is a problem now with the forest tradition. Because there's people the world over in Thailand and others, They lose a bit of faith with the monks who live in the city, who have TVs and have money and have property. They lose a bit of faith in those. So now they go and give all their donations to the forest monasteries and thereby spoil them all. So please, be very careful. If you make any funding for our monastery, don't give us too much. We're putting all our monastery into the retreat center, which is for you guys, not for us. So we try and keep our forest monastery simple. Please don't spoil it by giving us too much. Because that's one of the dangers. You get so much respect, you know, for the forest monks that don't have any time to meditate because they're the ones you come to for counseling. They're the ones you invite overseas. They're the ones you give money and donations to. And I've seen many forest monasteries being spoiled that way. So as a teacher, I've got to be very controlling on that. Not to try and get more money into my monastery, but try and stop it by putting it somewhere else. That's why we're doing a retreat center. You know, that's the money can go to that. That's for lay people to learn how to meditate. But our monastery, we've got to keep it simple. When we do things like that, we get a very good Sangha, a very good group of monks. And the whole forest tradition there is supposed to be not just thinking for the time being. And you know, myself being a teacher, I only come to Singapore infrequently. And one of the reasons is that I spend a lot of time back in Perth training my monks. Because I realize that, you know, one day I'm going to die. When I die, who's going to carry on? So you're always even now training other monks and nuns. And I'm very happy. I call these my babies. These little monks like Ajahn Bhumali, who's taught here, Ajahn Kemavara. I'm just releasing another one of my babies coming to coming to the Buddhist Fellowship next month, Venerable Mudita. And you know, that gives me so much joy, just like any other parent. You know, you see your child starting to do well in life. And I realized that this is one of the main reasons we have forest monasteries, is training grounds for monks and nuns. And how do we train these monks and nuns? We don't give them classes, you know, like, you know, staying, sitting in front of a desk and give them exams at the end of the year. That's not how we train. We train them by putting them in situations and making them learn on the job. Here's your hut. Stay in it. Now, one of the rules in my monastery, this is typical forest monastery type rule. You can only stay in your hut for 2 years at most. And then you have to move to another hut. So you never get too attached, you know, to your little hut. And also, when you move, you have to carry everything by hand to your next hut. You can't use the tractor. You can't get removal van. Because when you're carrying all your own things, you realize just how much you can amass, even as a monk, in 1 or 2 years. You know, a book, you know, pens or whatever. So imagine doing that. You have to take everything yourself and carry it to your next hut. You remember by this little rule the weight and the burden of possessions. So you try and let go as much as you possibly can. Because all the stuff you have, all you women, how many dresses have you got in your wardrobe? And you're still going out trying to buy some more. And how many can you actually wear at one time? You know how many dresses I've got in my wardrobe? This one, that's it. And how many shoes have you got for just two little feet? I love that. Like as a monk, it's wonderful to know the burden of possessions. Okay, when you're young and you're chasing boys, you need a few dresses. Once you've caught the boy, you can give all the nice dresses away. But anyhow, you get to know what I mean. We try and keep it very simple in this forest monastery by having these types of rules. But also in our forest tradition, we have another little tradition which gives an idea of like the training of how to be simple, how to be peaceful. That after 5 years as a monk in a monastery, you're encouraged to leave. To leave and go wandering around, carrying all your possessions with you. And that was one of the most beautiful experiences of my life as a monk. After 5 years in these monasteries of Thailand, I left the monastery walking with all the possessions I owned in the whole world carried with me. In about 3 days, I had lessened those possessions by about 50%. Because I had to carry them and walk. And after about 3 or 4 days, I was just this wonderful sense of absolute freedom. Everything I owned was light. My bowl, a spare robe, a water jar, a cup. And I could go anywhere I wanted in Thailand. I know that the next village, wherever it was, I could go on alms round and I'd always get some rice. Maybe nothing else, but that's enough to keep you going for the next day. Sometimes you get more than that. And I knew I could always sleep any place, in the fields, in an abandoned monastery, under a tree in the jungle. It was a wonderful experience of total freedom. Every crossroads I came to, or every crossroads of paths in the jungle, I could go left, right, straight on, or just turn around. I had no appointments, no diary, nothing to go to, nowhere to run away from. Completely free. Can you imagine what that feels like? That felt like I was a bird. I was totally free from attachments and from things which binded me. I could go wherever I wanted, flowing with the wind in whatever direction, like a leaf being blown in the sky on a windy day. That was me, light like a feather. That was what a monk is like. These days, whenever I get blown on SIA to Singapore or to Thailand or somewhere. And much, many more burdens to perform. But, I know how to let go of these things and be free and peaceful. That's what the forest teaches you. The forest teaches you about nature. About all these animals and birds and insects. How free they can be. If you ever notice some of the great teachings, they always come from nature. I was visiting our monastery where Ajahn Chah lived last January. And of course I had a few of the monks from a monastery in Perth alongside of me. And I was reminiscing. You know what you do when you sort of go back to places where you grew up which meant so much for you. This is where I grew up as a monk. And I said, this is where Ajahn Chah said this to me. This is where Ajahn Chah said that to me. And I got to the point where Ajahn Chah stopped when we were coming back from alms round. He picked up a stick on the ground. And he held it up and said, Brahma Wangso. That's what he used to call me, Brahma Wangso. Is this heavy? And before I could answer whether the stick was heavy or not, it was quite a big stick, he threw it away. He said, it's only heavy when you hold it. And those are the simple teachings which actually hit you right deep inside and you always remembered. The death of a loved one, is that heavy? Only when you hold it. The economic crisis, is that heavy? Only when you worry about it. The cancer in your body, is that heavy? Only when you are concerned about it. Teachings like this, of seeing a stick in the forest and throwing it away, those were better than any sermons. You could study the Abhidhamma, you can learn Pali and go to all of these courses. But nothing was as powerful as seeing an example of letting go and why life is sometimes heavy for you. Keep on holding it. Let it go. You've got the great stories of the forest monks who understood human nature just so deeply. Like that wonderful story. I'm reminiscing now. Please excuse me. Being in the car with Ajahn Chah. He was a driver. Ajahn Chah was in the passenger seat. There were three monks. We were getting a lift to the station to go down to Bangkok to do our visa. We had to renew our visas every year. And Ajahn Chah turning around and looking at the novice monk sitting next to me, Gary. He was from New Mexico. And I always remember this story. He turned around to Gary and he said, in Thai, you're thinking about your girlfriend. And that was translated. One of the other monks was a great translator and translated it back. And poor Gary, his face dropped. Ajahn Chah was reading his mind. These great monks could do things like that, so you shouldn't think about your girlfriend in front of great monks. So you can imagine how you felt. You've been embarrassed. But then Ajahn Chah is such a compassionate and wise man. He said, look, never mind. I can help you. And he told this monk through the translator, look, next time you write to your girlfriend who is in L.A., ask her to send you something of her, something personal. So whenever you miss her, you can take that out to remind you of her. Such a romantic man. Ajahn Chah. And even I was surprised. And this Gary Lovis actually asked, you know, is that okay according to the rules? Is that allowable? Can a monk do that? And Ajahn Chah, I remember him nodding and said, oh yes, 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 yes. Remember, I'd only been with Ajahn Chah about 6 months. Now, after a while, you knew when he was acting like that, he was up to something. And then he said to the translator something in Thai, which I didn't understand. And the translator, he was laughing himself silly. I thought he almost fell out of the car with laughter. And when he pulled himself together, he said, Ajahn Chah said this, yes, it is allowable. A monk can do that. You should send, next time you write a letter to your girlfriend back in L.A., send her a little bottle and ask her to send it back full of some of her shit. It's personal. So the next time you miss her, you can open up the bottle and say, just smell your girlfriend. That's my girl back in L.A. Well, don't you always say, I love everything about you, my dear? And that's Ajahn Chah for you. Gross, down to earth, funny, but just so true. Those people who are now falling in love with your girlfriend, do you really love everything about your boyfriend? So what it's doing is saying, yeah, love is there, but remember when you do love another person, you know, it's not just the beautiful part you love, you have to love the other part of them, because we've all got our beauty and our ugly parts, the parts which we really admire and the other ones which irritate us. What he was saying is that's life. So please get real. That if you have any relationship at all, a real relationship, it's not just loving the nice part about your partner. It's also loving the irritating part as well. And that's the relationship. That's where love is strong. And if you think that love can only occur when your partner is perfect, you'll never find that love. You're wasting your time, and you find you can never live with anybody. There's an old story about that. Again, nothing to do with Forest Edition. About this girl. No, the boy, sorry. This boy, he's from Singapore. And he came from a good family. His parents were reasonably rich. And he had a very good education. He went to Harvard, came back. It was time for him to get married. And so he decided, because he came from a wealthy family, got a great education, really fit, a good sportsman, he thought he'd go and look for the most beautiful, the most perfect girl in the whole of Singapore. So he wanted to marry the most perfect girl. So he looked all around Singapore, the nightclubs and bars and Buddhist fellowship, got a lot of beautiful. And eventually he found this really beautiful girl. Oh, she was such a good looker, so hot. She could appear on the front page of a glossy magazine. But he couldn't marry her. She was very beautiful, but she couldn't cook. So instead, he went to New York. And in New York, he found a girl who was even more beautiful. And she had her own restaurant. She was an amazing cook. But he couldn't marry her either, because she was stupid. She's not perfect enough. So he went to the last place, Perth, Western Australia, where I live. And there he found the most beautiful girl he'd ever seen in the whole world. And she was so intelligent. She had a double PhD. And her cooking was just so delicious. Even thinking about it would make the saliva drip from your mouth. She was the perfect girl. But he couldn't marry her either. because she was looking for the perfect boy. So we always want the perfect partner, but are we perfect? No. So cut your losses. And stay with what you've got. That's the sort of thing which we learn in the forest. We're at nature. We're not sort of in the... We're actually in the real world rather than the make-believe world of, like, you know, movies and Batman and I don't know who else, man. Still haven't got Supermark yet in the movies. Batman is Superman, but he's not got Supermark. Anyone who knows Steven Spielberg or any of these big directors in the United States, the Buddhist Fellowship, Angie's very good on writing scripts. We can do the next script of Supermark, who lives in a forest monastery and flies through the air and actually saves all the problems in the world. 9/11, he grabs hold with his psychic powers of those planes, turns them around and go in the other direction. And the Muslim terrorists, he teaches them Dharma, gives them the 5 precepts, and then they don't need to go to jail. You do a great script for Supermuck. Anyway, I know how many have had to get onto Supermuck with Forest Muck. Anyway, living in the forest tradition, simplicity, peace, kindness, wisdom. That's actually what that tradition represents. It's a very valuable tradition in the world. It's authentic. So you in the Buddhist Fellowship, when you have forest monasteries over in Thailand, over in Australia, in England, wherever, please care for them by not giving them too much. I mean that. If you want to give requisites, be careful. How many robes can I have? You don't need to keep giving me robes. When you give me robes, this is a simple robe. Can you hold up my bag again? There's patches on those. See all the patches on the thing? See the corners here? They're just fraying. Because I've used this about 3 or 4 or 5 years. So don't say, oh, he's got a patched bag. I'm going to offer him a new one. Don't. This is good enough. Because what we're doing over there, I'm trying to live by example. To say, well, I can use this bag for 4 or 5 years. How often do you have to replace your handbag? So patch it up. Make use of it. And then you can show simplicity and be someone who can have simple things or easy things. This robe, if you look at it, it's not made by Gucci. It's not Versace. It was actually made by monks. And that way we are exemplifying, encouraging simplicity, experience, meditation, understanding the Dhamma from deep inside. And that's why these forest monks are so powerful in this world. They have little. But I can go to amazing places. I can have breakfast with the president of Sri Lanka without any money whatsoever. Last August, I was at this leadership retreat in an invitation-only exclusive resort in Hayman Island off the Great Barrier Reef. You know, with our Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, the Deputy Prime Minister of Australia Julia Gillard, the Treasurer of Australia Wayne Swan, the Premier of Victoria Mr. Brumby, the Premier of Queensland Anna Bligh, the head of all these banks, the CEOs of BHP, Billiton, big mining companies. I think the CEO of KPMG was there as well, not just in Australia, from overseas. It's great leadership conference. And there I was, the only monk without a bank account, without a cent, with just my robe. They were all in these nice suits, all the nice dresses and jewellery and stuff. And I also had dinner with Queen Elizabeth a couple of years ago when she came to Canberra. All her jewellery sparkling. I never had anything with sparkle. Amazing. I've got absolutely nothing. No money. Oh, this is a robe which I went to see Queen Elizabeth in. Same old robe I come to Buddhist Fellowship in. This is what happens when you're so simple and peaceful. You just go into all sorts of areas of life where rich people just cannot go. You have to give up the world to be able to go and meet such people. fascinating life being a forest monk. And sometimes, you know, you go and just work mixing concrete with your friends. Because as a monk, forest monk, we don't just teach, we actually work hard. This is how we keep fit. Instead of just doing exercise, what a waste of energy. Do something, sweep the ground, wash the dishes, do something useful with your energy. So we actually build. Those who go to my monastery, most of those buildings, I am the builder. I built those buildings. I remember once I'd just been busy mixing concrete. Even though I was the abbot, I still joined in with everybody else. Just because you're abbot, you're not the big shot. Forest monasteries, all the monks are absolutely equal, except when we sit on in any ceremonies. So there I was, mixing up the concrete, enjoying myself, you know, boys' toys with a cement mixer, getting cement all over you. I love that. And of course, the cement is splashy. I have all these grey spots all over you, over my face, over my robes. I looked a right mess. And I was just walking from the little hut we were building, you know, to the shower block to have a shower. And as I was walking, it was actually a Sri Lankan girl. She was visiting. She's obviously a very wealthy or high caste Sri Lankan girl. She was dressed in a very immaculate sari with makeup and jewelry. She was really dressed out like going to town. But she passed me and she said, excuse me, first time here, where can I see the abbot? Now I thought very quickly. My wisdom has saved me many times. And I said, well, if you just go up to that hall over there, he should be there in about, I didn't have a clock, he should be there in about 5 or 10 minutes. She said, thank you very much. So I quickly went and had a shower and changed into my nice robe. And I went to see her and talked Dhamma to her, you know, gave her some advice. And at the end, she was very impressed. She said, wow, this is a great monastery. That's very wise teachings. I love this place, except for one thing. If you don't mind me saying, you should talk to your monks. Because I saw this very sloppy, badly dressed, dirty monk on the way up here. She never recognized it was me. And so I told her, oh, okay, madam, I will talk to him afterwards. And I did. I talked to myself. That's a forest monk for you, a forest monk's life. We have a lot of fun, great humour with all the other monks. But we keep it simple. We do heaps and heaps of meditation. Because we want to sort of keep this beautiful tradition just as in the time of the Buddha. Hardly any possessions, no money, no sex, no hanky-panky. If you want hanky-panky, that's fine, but put a pair of trousers on and just leave the monastery. You want happy monks. If this is what you want, stay here. If you want something else, go outside. I know this one person said he wanted to become a monk as long as he could have every Saturday evening off. No, you can't do that. This is a profession all the time. So that we're monks, we're real monks, we're true monks. Check us out. If you really want to, you get a PI and have him follow me around and see what Ajahn Brahm does. If you do things like that, it means that, you know, you're actually living authentically. And the forest monks should be authentic. Outside of the city, have fewer distractions. And with those fewer distractions, we can live a more peaceful and simple life. So if you do come to a monastery, please don't go and bring a TV to offer, or a radio, or a mobile phone. Many people have actually tried to press mobile phones on me, and I've said no, 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 no. So sometimes you say, can I have your email address? I do not have email. Someone's trying to set one up for me, but I'm fighting tooth and nail against it. We're trying to live simply, for goodness sake. Which means, you know, you cannot contact me that easily. But that also means that I have more time to be peaceful, to be wise, and I can live much longer. And I don't have to spend all night answering your silly emails. So that means I can live much longer and serve much longer. So try and keep it simple and try and keep this beautiful attitude of a monk living as peaceful and simple, a free life as possible. That's the forest tradition. And I think that most people, they see that, they get inspired. At last, there's a religion, a spirituality where people are actually practicing it. The last little story, Venerable Agachitta, who lives up in Malaysia, I mean, even outside of Taiping. He wanted to start a monk training center. Because he also realized that, you know, to have a strong Buddhism in Malaysia, we have to have, you know, really good teachers, monks and nuns who really are well trained, not scholastically as much as experientially. But he did something really quite innovative. He decided to have a survey. He printed out a questionnaire which he put at so many monasteries and temples and Dharma centers in Malaysia. And the question was, what do you want from your monks? There's a tick boxes. Do you want your monk to be a great Dharma speaker or to write inspiring books? 3, to be a counselor you can go to whenever you have problems. 4, to be like a manager, administrator, who can actually administer temples. To be a fundraiser. To be like someone who meditates deeply, and a meditation teacher, or somebody who keeps his precepts well, or somebody who can actually run Dharma schools for children, or somebody who can, what else can you say? I'm not quite sure what else there was. But of all of those I've mentioned so far, the one which most people ticked, which won such a clear majority, was they wanted their monks to keep their rules of Vinaya. They wanted to be proud of their monks and nuns, even more than being a teacher or a counselor or a manager or someone to teach their kids. What most people in Malaysia wanted from their monks and nuns was to be monks and nuns who were authentic, who kept the rules, the precepts, who they could look up to as examples of virtuous beings. When I saw that, I felt so relieved that my respect for the lay community in Malaysia increased enormously. Because too many monks say, well, we've got to accept money, because otherwise we make life too difficult for our lay supporters. I've got to have a car, otherwise, you know, you have to go to so much trouble driving me here and driving me there. I have to have a TV to find out what's going on in the world, you know, in the latest soap opera, Neighbours, EastEnders, whatever else you watch on the TV. I've got to be able to watch the soccer so I can relate to people who support Manchester United. And that's what they say. They say they're doing this out of compassion for the lay community. But the lay community came back and said, no, that's not what we want. And it's wonderful that the lay community, the lay Buddhists in Malaysia, made it very clear, as you would in Singapore if I asked you and did a survey, what you want of the monks and nuns of all traditions in this nation is to have monks and nuns who keep their rules, you can be proud of, as Buddhists look up to, say, our monks and nuns are simple. Our monks and nuns aren't so worried about material things. Our monks and nuns are celibate. They don't have mistresses on the side. Our monks and nuns are just, they're not so worried about their own personal possessions. Our monks and nuns keep their rules. That's what most people want. That's why we have forest traditions as examples. It can be done. It has been done. I've done it for 34 years. And look how fat I am. And happy as well. So, that's the talk so far on the forest tradition and just what monks and nuns are really supposed to be about. So, any questions? Q&A time now.
Can we say sadhu 3 times, Ajahn Brahm? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, questions time. Since Ajahn Brahm don't answer to email questions, here's your chance to ask him.
Yes. Okay, how, when I went from the city into the jungles, and again, a foreign country of Thailand, how did I conquer my fear? I will never forget, I can visualize it right now, the time I walked in to Ajahn Chah's monastery for the first time. I went through the gate. It was one of the most peaceful places I'd ever met in my life. It was so quiet. And it wasn't just the fact the forests were quiet. It was the atmosphere of so many people meditating for such a long time in the monastery where Ajahn Chah lived. That hit me so strongly that I could visualize it, I could remember it, this 34 years later. The first day which I walked into Ajahn Chah's monastery, he wasn't there, he was on an out and arms round. The whole place was so silent, so beautifully peaceful. That inspiration was what conquered any fear. This is a beautiful, peaceful, and incredibly moving place to be in. And these other things, they weren't as important as the inspiration which I felt. Yes? Anyway, okay. When you're meditating at night in total darkness, in the jungle, in forest monastery where cremations happen every night, chock-a-block full of ghosts, and there weren't many ghosts in that monastery, are you afraid? Somehow or another, maybe because of faith, maybe just because of inspiration, you saw all those other monks. I never heard of any monk being attacked by a ghost. No monk could be eaten by a tiger. At least if they had, they weren't left to say the story. But actually, being maybe a Westerner, because reason was also strong, what have you got to be afraid of? So I used my reason, I used my faith, I used my inspiration, my faith in my teacher. He said, there's nothing to be afraid of. And I had enough confidence to believe him. There was nothing to be afraid of there. Darkness was wonderful. Every time when I used to go on this walking tour, sometimes people would come and bother you. Well, first of all, I thought they were asking questions on Dhamma. But then one day, this one lady came up to me. I was in the forest, and she put a bottle of Pepsi Cola, a piece of paper, and a pencil next to it. By this time I knew exactly what she wanted. The bottle of Pepsi Cola was not an offering, it was a bribe. The piece of paper and pencil was to write down next week's lottery number. They always thought that these monks who meditated could see the numbers. And when I told Ajahn Chah about it, he said, look, that's what Thai people are like. So what you should do, when you ever want to get some peace and quiet, when you go to the village in the afternoon on your walkabout, ask them where the cremation ground is. And that's where you stay at night. And no villager, even if they wanted to find out the lottery numbers, would dare come and bother you. So actually I love those cremation grounds, because actually that you are protected. It's the most quiet and peaceful place. And as I've told you many times here, the ghosts are terrified of monks like me. We've got far more power than they have. That's why it's like, imagine you saw a tiger come in. You'd run for your life. And that's what a ghost see a monk coming. We've got too much power for those ghosts. They're lower beings. So that's why the ghosts are really afraid of good monks. So I'm not afraid of them. If they create a problem, get out of here or you'll be in trouble, ghost. Yeah? What makes me become a monk? Okay, this is no jokes. This is meditation. There is sometimes, as still as a student, it's weird and strange, it must be from past lives, I still had my girlfriend, sleeping with her. It was the late 60s. I'm honest with people. And there was a meditation retreat on. So I said goodbye to my girlfriend in Gloucester, went off to the meditation retreat. And obviously had some ability then, but it was a very powerful deep meditation, which was more blissful than being with my girlfriend. And that actually shook me. How can there be so much peace and joy and bliss in this world? And it sort of made me really interested in meditation and also why that was just so amazingly deep and peaceful and blissful. And it was those experiences which wanted me to investigate more about what is this spirituality all about. And of course, once you became a monk, you went deeper into those meditations and then found out the nature of existence, why we're here. At the same time, it's not you find truth and you're miserable. People who find truth and wisdom are the most happiest people in the world. So, I wanted happiness. So this is where you found it. There's something else I always wanted to do in life. Not my own happiness. Like many of you, you all have compassion and care. I wanted to make other people happy. And look at me now. A very, very, very happy monk. I spend so much time sharing these teachings and making other people happy. What a better life can you have? So, as job satisfaction, my job satisfaction is through the roof, way out of the stratosphere. It's out of this world, my job satisfaction. So when I teach, you can really help people so much. Just, I was told the other day about that little book which I wrote. A lady, an English lady, seconded to the Romanian government to reform the penal system based on the philosophy of opening the door of your heart. How many people am I going to affect there? All these people who have to go to prison in Romania. They're changing the system here to be compassionate, wise, based on my book. That was such an enormous amount of praise for me. The fact that, you know, you've actually done something, you've changed something big time in the world for good. So my job satisfaction, wow. And not only that, just my own happiness. Wow.
And if we eat meat at the same time, would that affect our state of meditation?
If you're meditating and eat meat, I ate frog and it didn't do anything to my meditation. So maybe you should try... Well, maybe you should try frog and rice and see what that does to you. No, just try not to be so choosy and so fussy. If you can eat vegetarian, fine. If you go to somebody's house and they serve you frog, fine. Yes?
Sorry, we have time for one last question because we have to let Ajahn has his meal. Hopefully it's not frog and rice.
Disappoint now, yes.
Yes, please.
Okay. I'll answer the second question first. The prerequisite to being a monk is to be a man. That's all. If you're not a man, you could be a nun. So basically, there is no entry requirement. You don't have to have degrees or finish school. Because one of the most wonderful things about being a monk is, and this is my own experience, you're surprised at how many people, unexpected, can make wonderful monks. So now, after all these years, I just say, if you want to try, you're most welcome to come and try. And I'm not going to bar you. There's one young man now who's suffered from extreme schizophrenia. And he came as just a postulant, anagarika in white. And I was, this guy's not going to last. But out of compassion, I gave him a try. There's a couple of times that he saw himself losing it. And he went and phoned, had the ambulance come to admit himself. When he did things like that, I got a lot of trust in this fellow. He was mindful enough to know his state of mind, to know when he needed to go in the hospital and up his medication. After a couple of years, I've ordained him as a novice monk. He's a wonderful fella. He's a success story. And the nice thing is, I gave somebody I usually wouldn't give any possibility of being a monk, and gave him a chance. And he's risen to the occasion beyond all my expectations. his doctor. He has to still see his doctor once a month. His doctor is incredibly impressed. It's impossible, it's happening. He wants to do a case study about this fellow. People like that tell me that whoever you are, I will give you a chance to be a monk. Because I don't know, I can't say anymore whether you're going to make it or not. But I say I'll give you that chance. So that's the first question. Just be a man, you can come. And about, it's hard to be a Buddhist, you know whether you're doing the right thing or wrong thing. Really, that being a Buddhist is the easiest thing in the world. Because you don't have to judge yourself so harshly. In other words, you try your very best. If you make a mistake, there's no punishment for Buddhists. You're forgiven straight away. Sometimes people come and they ask forgiveness of me. Because that's some of the traditions in the false tradition. Ask forgiveness of the teacher. And whenever you do that, I always give you forgiveness in the three time zones. Forgive for everything you've ever done in the past. Forgive you for what you're doing now. And forgive you for whatever you do in the future. You're pre-forgiven. No matter what you do, you already have my forgiveness. Because there's no punishment there. There's no measuring. There's no ill will. Understanding that, you feel it's a tremendous amount of freedom. You don't have to work so hard to succeed in your religion. You have to be gentle and kind to succeed. Be forgiving. And that's how we grow. Doesn't matter where you start from as a Buddhist. As long as you're improving even a slight amount every day, then you have my full respect. So it is actually easy. You make mistakes, you do stupid things. But if I see you doing stupid things, like Ajahn Chah, see me do stupid things, and I'd expect to be punished. He would just think it was so funny. He would laugh. Every time I made an idiot of myself, I made him happy. But don't worry about trying too hard. One of the problems of Buddhists in places like Singapore, you're just trying too hard to get enlightened. So, just be peaceful, be gentle. Accept yourself. The door of my heart, say to yourself, is open to me as I am, with no conditions. With all the silly little things you do, love them. And then it's just so wonderful being a Buddhist. You can be at peace with who you are, rather than having this great idea you try to live up to. That's how to be a Buddhist. The easiest thing in the world.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. I'm sure you have lots of questions to ask Ajahn. He'll be around, don't worry. Come to the seminar this afternoon. Out of compassion, we have one gentleman, one brother here who want to say one last question. Eh? Yes. So this will definitely be the last question.
Ajahn. Ajahn, this is not a question. This is for you to listen. I spent 4 weeks at your monastery. It was heavenly. Paradise. I had a taste of paradise. So.
Okay, before we invite Ajahn to conduct the end of service blessings, some announcements. I talk about the seminar this afternoon. Tickets are still on sale. Those of you who are not members, you might want to consider being a member because being a member has its privileges, including the tickets. For members, it is only $20, and non-members, $80. So it really pays to be a member. It's only $30 a year. For new members, in fact, you'll get a free CD of stories told by none other than Ajahn Brahm himself. Of stories from opening the doors to your heart. We are also having a meditation retreat, the repeat of this year's retreat at Khao Lak. This will be on 28th of May 2009, so mark that down in your calendar. And again, as a special to BF members, the Jhana Grove that Ajahn Brown spoke about in Perth, understand that it is near completion, and by early next year, it will be completed. Yes. And so Ajahn Brown had kindly extended an invitation to BF members to have a special retreat there. So look out for the dates in our calendars.